Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
I'm an ordinary guy burning down the house.
Of course, you know, the quotes are usually longer, so I took a drink of water. You were done by the time I was ready to spit.
Yeah. So we wanted to talk about firefighting technology. We actually had a request come over Facebook for this, and we wanted to, I thought that was a good request. You know, it was an interesting concept. We also, I think I got an email about it as well. So we've had some people inquire about the technology used in firefighting, and there's a wide range of tech that we can talk about. Some of it is stuff that is based off of technology that's been around for more than a century, and some of it is really like space age type stuff.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd start with one of the most iconic images when you think about firefighting, which of course is the fire engine or fire truck.
Okay.
So I actually live not too far from a fire station, and by not too far, I mean adjacent. And and so I get to see fire trucks a lot, as it turns out. They're pretty cool things. And of course, you know, the main I think the main feature on a fire truck has to be the water tank that it holds.
Right.
You know, and the water tanks, depending on the size of the truck, the water tank can be a different size as well. Like, you know, it's not unusual to find a fire truck that can hold 1,000 gallons of water on its own. And of course, that's important because there's no guarantee that wherever the fire is going to be close to either a pool of water or a fire hydrant. A fire truck has to be able to carry its own portable water supply. But having water on a truck is not enough. You have to have a way of getting that water out.
Right. So you would need some kind of pump.
Yes. And fire engines have pumps. They have impeller water pumps. And an impeller water pump is a diesel-powered pump. So it's got its own independent diesel engine.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a rotor-like device that's got some curved blades on it that spin in the water tank. Now, this actually slings the water around and starts to move it in a circular fashion. It builds water pressure. And you relieve that water pressure by allowing the water to escape through water lines, also known as hoses. So they have to go through a valve, and then it goes through the hose and at the whatever is burning thing.
The whatever is burning thing?
Yeah, that's a technical term in the firefighting trade. So the whatever is burning thing gets deluged with water. And there's actually some interesting controls on this. There's a series of controls. There's a pump panel that allows you to either manually control the pumps or some of them are automated. They have like a mastermind control system that actually does this automatically. But a typical pump panel will have levers on it that allow you to direct where the water is going to go through, like which lines it's going to go through. And of course, that's all going to depend upon which lines have been connected to the truck. And there are lots of different kinds of water lines also. And again, when I say water lines, those are essentially the fire hoses.
Right. Yeah. These are a lot different from your garden variety hoses.
Yes. Yes.
Because they can handle a whole lot more pressure and deliver a whole lot more water. As Jonathan was saying just a moment ago, you can't be certain that you're going to be right next to a fire hydrant where the fire is. And the fire truck is going to park on the street. Now, if the building, let's say it's a building is burning and it's away from the street, you've got to have enough water pressure to get to the fire itself. So yeah. The hoses are long. They've got some diameter on them so you can really carry the a good amount of water, and they've got to be able to withstand a lot of pressure.
Yeah, and they tend to be treated for mildew resistance as well, because one of the big problems with fire hoses before the mildew resistant film was developed was that you had to dry them out after you used them.
Yes.
Because otherwise you would have mildew develop, it would start to rot the hoses, and then the hoses would not be stable. You could have a hose rupture while you're trying to fight a fire because it's been weakened by mildew. So, there's a lot of elements that go into creating these hoses. And I've got a few different types that I can talk about. There's usually a booster line, which is only about an inch diameter, and it's usually used for small fires, like a minor fire inside a building or something like that, or a minor brush fire even.
Uh-huh.
Then you've got the cross-lay hoses. These are the main hoses. These are like the workhorses of a fire engine. They're located below the pump panel, and they can pump up to 95 gallons of water per minute. They tend to be about 200 feet long, and they've got a diameter of an inch and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So then you've got the pre-connect lines. So like I said, you know, you've got all these valves that are attached to the fire engine, and they're on all the different sides of the fire engine because you never know where you're going to be able to orient the engine in relation to the fire. Normally there are at least three lines that are pre-connected when an engine rolls out of the station. So that way the firefighters have a chance to immediately jump out of the truck and start fighting the fire without having to fuss with unloading a hose, connecting it to the right valve, and then engaging the valve and fighting the fire that way. So pre-connect lines tend to be between an inch and a half to 2 inches in diameter, and they tend to be able to pump out around 250 gallons of water per minute.
Mm-hmm.
You've got hoses that are designed specifically to hook up to hydrants, fire hydrants. Those are 5 inches in diameter. And a fire engine may carry up to 1,000 feet of this hose, but it's in 100-foot segments. But there are also other shorter segments called curb jumper hoses.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that the building that you need to get about 150 feet of hose to get to the fire at whatever location you're at, and you're hooking it up to a hydrant, you might not want to grab two lengths of the hydrant hose. That's 200 feet, and you know you only need 150. That that means you're going to have an extra 50 feet of hose that you're going to have to maneuver around. Well, these curb jumper hose segments are typically in lengths between 25 foot lengths and 50 foot lengths. Mm-hmm. So that way it's easier just to grab a smaller section so that you have enough length of hose to get to where you're going without having excess. Then you've got your hose pack, which is a lighter hose. It's usually a smaller diameter. And this is what is used by firefighters if they have to go into a building and climb up levels. It has to be more portable. You've got the ladder line. You know, most of these fire engines have a really long ladder that's on the back of them. Yeah. Well, there's a line that is part of that ladder. It's a direct connection to the ladder.
It's actually built in.
Yeah, it's built in, and there is a nozzle at the top of the ladder that can shoot out. It's usually around 300 gallons per minute, so it's a pretty powerful hose. And then you've got your deluge gun or deck gun. That's what's mounted on the top of the pump panel. That's the one that, you know, if you ever look at a fire engine, you see something that looks like a turret that's on the fire engine.
Yeah,
that's the thing I'm talking about. All right, so we've been talking about hoses that can shoot out between 95 gallons and 300 gallons of water. The deluge gun is no joke. We're talking 1,000 gallons a minute.
Wow.
Yeah. And you may say, well, if you've got 1,000 gallons in the tank, does that mean that after a minute you've completely exhausted your water supply? And the answer is, well, yeah, if you were just using the water in the tank. But you can also hook up a line to a pool or lake or pond and use that water to pump into the various lines that you're using. Now, for that, they use a strainer. It's called a barrel strainer, and that's what is used to filter out debris in ponds and pools and that kind of thing in order to be able to use that water to fight fires. Because, of course, if you get debris caught in the line, then you've fouled the line. You are, you know, in danger of losing the fight against the fire. But
plus, I imagine it would do quite a bit of costly damage to the equipment as well.
Sure. Yes. All of that is an important thing to remember when you are trying to fight fires. And then there's also trucks tend to also carry foam. Mm-hmm. And there's different kinds of foam that's used for different types of fires. Usually, a fire engine may only carry one type of foam, especially if it's in an area where fires are typically one type versus another. For example, a Class A foam is a kind of foam that's used to soak down an area after you've put out a fire to prevent reignition. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a flame retardant. And then you've got like Class B foam. That's the stuff that you use to fight flammable liquid fires. So like a car fire, you might want to use that because of the gasoline problem.
Right.
So, and then the other part about fire engines, they are like mobile tool kits. Mm-hmm. So that's where all the firefighting tools are mounted in that. And you may have some pretty low-tech stuff in there. I mean, things like hooks and pikes that are used to tear down walls so that you can get at the places where the fire is to put the fire out. There's not a lot of tech there.
Right.
But then you may have something like a chainsaw. You know, chainsaws have that. There's some tech there.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It's pretty simple tech. It's usually, you know, a diesel engine that turns the chain so that you can cut through stuff. But then there's also a pretty famous tool, I would say, that you typically we'll find on a fire engine.
Yeah, and I think I know where you're going with this since you just mentioned it a moment ago. But yep. I think it's important to remember before while you're trying to guess what this famous tool is that firefighters these days often do a lot more than fighting fires. They're also responsible for doing some paramedic work. Mm-hmm. You know, they're first responders. So if someone is injured, they often call the firefighters out on the possibility that in addition to medical care, there might be a fire related to it, and they might need to do both things. Like, for example, as Jonathan was just pointing out, if you had a car wreck and there's a possibility that gasoline might spill and catch fire. So you have someone trapped in a car. There's a possibility that there might be a fire. So who better to send than firefighters who are trained in medical care? But the trick is getting them out of the car before something bad happens.
Yes, and this tool comes in. It's called the Jaws of Life. And really, Jaws of Life is actually a series of tools. It is not a single tool. There's a company that makes these tools, and the company is known as the Jaws of Life Company. It actually has a full name, but it escapes my mind off the top of my head. But it's not that kind. You still haven't seen that movie, have you?
No, I have not.
Yeah, we had someone ask us earlier. No, he has not seen Jaws. So Jaws of Life is...
Those are the Jaws of Death.
Yeah. Jaws of Life, it's a hydraulically powered tool. Mm-hmm. And by that we mean it uses a fluid to create pressure and move heavy-duty tool elements. Mm-hmm. And I guess a little digression on hydraulic fluid would be a good idea here.
Sure.
So... A hydraulic fluid is a fluid that is typically it's not compressible. It's incompressible. And by that, I mean you cannot squish it, right?
Right.
Like most things that we think about, there's a little squish factor. But hydraulic fluid is supposed to be incompressible. And that means that the fluid's at maximum density. You cannot cram the molecules of that fluid any tighter than it already is. So if you put pressure on it, it's going to push.
Yeah, like if you have a cylinder filled with hydraulic fluid and you're trying to push press a piston into the cylinder at the point where everything is connected, you have the solid cylinder at one end, mm-hmm. and then the piston starts to push on it. There's a point at which the piston is not going to be able to push anymore because it is compressed
yeah.
as far as it can go, and it will not compress any further. And you can use that to do work.
Yep. And there are plenty of tools that do use this. And the Jaws of Life use phosphate ester fluid. A lot of hydraulic fluid systems will use an oil-based fluid. As you can imagine, oil-based fluids are not necessarily the best thing to have in firefighting equipment.
I would imagine not.
Yeah. So phosphate ester is non-flammable and non-conductive. So these hydraulic tools, the Jaws of Life, there are actually, like I said, a line of them. And the ones that are typically used in firefighting are cutters, which do what they sound like they do. They are designed to cut through stuff. So, for example, the body of a car.
Mm-hmm.
Because the hydraulic pressure is such that it will cause the cutting edges of this device to close at such a force that metal just crumbles. And then you've got spreaders. Spreaders are kind of like, imagine a pair of pliers and you open them. That's kind of what spreaders are doing.
It's like pliers in reverse.
Yeah, you shove it into a gap and then you start the hydraulic motor start the diesel motor, and that starts the hydraulic fluid. It pushes the hydraulic fluid through and makes it do work, and that's what causes the pincers to open. And then you pop open whatever it is you were trying to open, or it tears apart one or the other. And then hydraulic rams.
Ah, yes.
So those are the three that are used the most frequently in firefighting scenarios. So, it's kind of neat. We actually have an article on how the Jaws of Life work, and it goes into detail on each of those tools. So if you want to learn more about it, I do recommend that. It's a very useful resource. And then... Also, I guess I should mention while we're talking about hydraulics, the ladder on the fire trucks, those are operated through hydraulics as well. There's a piston that is has got essentially two different hoses connected to it, and the hydraulic fluid will either cause the ladder to extend upward or to come back down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your basic fire engine from front to back. I mean, there's a lot more we could talk about, but there's so much more firefighting technology. I didn't want to just have this all be about fire engines.
Right, right.
So what do you want to talk about next?
Well, most of what I got is sort of high-tech, cutting-edge type stuff. One thing that we should talk about probably to some extent, or maybe we could cover it later if you want to go with all the high-tech stuff now, is the stuff that the firefighters actually wear on their person themselves.
Sure, yeah, let's talk about that. Because we just talked about fire engines, we should talk about the fire gear that the firefighters are wearing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They wear a lot.
Yes, they do. Of course, they have to try to stay protected from the heat. That's,
yeah.
It depends on what's burning, of course. some different types of materials will burn hotter than other materials. And you certainly don't want to have a firefighter go inside to rescue a person or to get at the source of a fire and have them pass out from the heat or to be overcome by heat and smoke inhalation. So you have to, you know, protect them externally and make sure that they can breathe, mm-hmm. make sure that they could see and, you know, keep them as cool as possible. One jacket that I read about that was really cool, it's actually called turnout gear, which is a, basically the heavy duty jacket that you might see them wear. It's actually from a company called Viking. But it's got thermal sensors built into the jacket itself.
Oh, cool.
Now, this is sort of, again, sort of cutting edge. But this different thing, has sensors on the outside, which change depending on, there's an LED display, on the jacket, and it will tell you at what point it is going to be a serious issue. The heat is going to be a serious issue.
The heat is going to be too hot for the suit's integrity.
And
the firefighter will be a danger.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it monitors what's going on outside and inside.
Oh.
So by looking at the firefighter, you know, another firefighter could say, look, you know, he's in danger right now being where he is and needs to get out of there because he may not be able to tell what's going on. He may be so focused on fighting the fire that he may be ignoring a potentially dangerous situation for himself.
In the heat of the moment.
Yes. Apparently, when the outer temperature of where the fire is gets to about 482 degrees Fahrenheit, the display, the LED display, starts to flash. And at 662 degrees Fahrenheit, it will start flashing very fast. I can't imagine being in anything that hot.
It's interesting because, well, first of all, you gotta know, you know, paper burns at Fahrenheit 451.
Yes.
But I was gonna say, you know, it's kind of interesting because if you look at the history of the heat resistant materials that firefighters have worn, the go-to material for quite some time was called Nomex.
Yeah.
Which is a fire resistant material. It's similar to nylon. It's kind of the same sort of, a feel of nylon, but it can withstand really intense heat. And it's a type of meta-aramid fiber, which really you just need to know that's a heat-resistant synthetic fiber that was developed in the lab. And it's actually kind of a distant relative to Kevlar, which is a much more resilient, not necessarily heat-resistant, but physically resilient material. Mm-hmm. So Nomex was the standard for a really long time. Back in 1990, the Houston Fire Department partnered with NASA to develop originally it was just to develop a new helmet for firefighters. But then eventually through this partnership, NASA suggested that perhaps they could completely redesign the firefighter suit. And they started to create suits that would circulate liquids within the suit's lining in order to remove heat so that it would protect the firefighter longer in intense heat conditions. Because before that point, the Houston firefighters were really only rated to go into areas that were 300 degrees Fahrenheit or cooler. Afterward, they could go into areas that were 500 degrees Fahrenheit or cooler. And now you're talking about a system where, you know, it warns you at 482, which is right around that, you know, that 500 degree range that I was just talking about, but it goes all the way up to 600, suggesting that this material is even more resilient than the stuff that was made back in 1990 with NASA. One of the other cool things that they added in that same project where they were redesigning the helmet, they created improved two-way radio link-ups in the helmets themselves.
Yes.
And they also created infrared camera system so that the firefighter could switch to a thermal view and see hot spots in the house. It will also help firefighters identify if any victims were in the area, so that they could see the heat from a person, then they would know that they needed to you might not be able to see because the smoke might be so thick.
Yeah.
And actually, infrared cameras play a really big role in firefighting technology across the board, not just in personal firefighter gear, but for example, a helicopter flying over a wildfire might be equipped. In fact, most of them are equipped with infrared cameras and infrared lenses so that they can So the pilot or the, well, it's not really the pilot, but a firefighter aboard the helicopter can look through and see the hot spots and see the flames, even if the smoke is so thick that you couldn't see anything, you know, just through a regular view to the ground. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that was a big digression, but you were going back to the cutting edge gear.
Yeah. Actually, we can keep going with that because
sure.
I was reading an article on in Popular Mechanics about some of the different cutting edge firefighting tools. Some firefighters for things like scenarios like that, you're talking about a fire in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Are using unmanned aircraft now to monitor areas and using infrared technology to identify places where you know, you can really concentrate on fighting the fire. The thing is, we haven't really talked about it yet. It's on our list of things to do, but these unmanned aerial, vehicles can stay in the air far longer than, human piloted aircraft. They can stay in the air for, well, the ones that they use in the military can stay in the air for, almost a day, I think, maybe even longer.
And they can fly through thick smoke that a pilot, depending on the type of aircraft, may not be able to fly through because, you know, smaller aircraft, which is often what's being used to fight fires, uses a lot of line of sight navigational techniques rather than flying by instruments. So if you're going to fly into an area that's got a really low visibility, that's very dangerous for the pilot. So it's much more safe to use a pilotless drone. I mean, you've got the person who's controlling it is controlling it from a workstation as opposed to mm-hmm. in a cockpit. Did you come across the I'm probably going to butcher this name because my Native American languages are non-existent. Ikana?
Yes, I did.
Ikhana. Yeah, it's a Predator B drone that NASA has that is specifically designed to fly through areas that are either threatened by wildfires or actually currently experiencing a wildfire. And it's got a lot of sensors on it that allow it to detect exactly the intensity and location of a fire to help firefighting strategies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't typically think of NASA as being a firefighting agency, but they have been partnering with the United States Forest Service in developing this technology and working on ways to keep forest fires from getting out of control. There's also moderate resolution imaging spectroradiometer, or MODIS. And basically that's there are two satellites in orbit around the Earth that are using instrumentation that can detect electromagnetic radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically over the course of a day or two, MODIS is keeping an eye on the Earth to look for radiation that would indicate where there's smoke and there's fire.
Right.
And you can look at things like you can sort of overlay this with areas of population density, areas of vegetation, things that might indicate that there is a serious imminent danger of, say, a fire spreading if it's going to get to a grassland or, you know, coming close enough to an area of population density where you need to start evacuating people to keep them out of the way. You know, using satellite imaging is a very sophisticated way of fighting fires because you can get if you'll pardon the well-worn expression, the big picture view of what's really going on mm-hmm. in a fire of a size like that. Of course, that's a much bigger fire than the ones we were starting out the podcast talking about.
Yeah. I mean, NASA's done a lot of work with satellites and fire detection. I mean, back in 2003, that's when they started to develop a software that would scan for fires. And then if a fire was detected, then NASA could direct a more powerful satellite to look at that area specifically. There's also the Landsat 7 satellite, which is designed to detect moisture levels in forested areas to determine likely spots where wildfires could form. Because, of course, a wildfire is more likely to form in a very dry area. Those conditions are prime for a wildfire because you've got a lot of dry fuel. And then if there's any wind, then that's going to spread that fire around very quickly in that area. So mm-hmm. that's sort of the purpose of Landsat 7 is just to kind of identify potential spots where a wildfire could develop with the right conditions. I mean, obviously, you're going to have something that's going to spark the fire.
I also read about in Popular Mechanics about some software developed by the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center called Prometheus. Yeah.
Nice. The bringer of fire.
Yes, exactly. In this case, it's actually designed to identify the likelihood of fire before it actually starts to burn.
Yep.
A very cool idea. Basically using, it's sort of like, if you think about it, it's sort of like meteorological models. Mm-hmm. They're taking environmental factors into account, ecological factors, and looking at those to get an idea of the likelihood of a forest fire starting and spreading. So they can kind of keep an eye on that before it even really, a conflagration starts.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Speaking of meteorological equipment, actually a lot of, well, fire stations tend to have a lot of meteorological equipment, actually on the station, mounted on the station. Because, you know, firefighters need to know this information. If mm-hmm. humidity is high, then they know that the fire is going to spread more slowly than if it were a dry day. They need to know what the wind speed and direction is, because that's going to affect how they attack a fire. It also will affect how a fire might spread. So a lot of weather equipment is, you'll find a lot of weather equipment attached to your typical fire station. So, and, you know, that way they have the most up-to-date information available before they go out to fight a fire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You want to hear about a couple other cutting-edge tools that
sure.
I ran into?
Yeah, the two I've got that I wanted to talk about are kind of future potential applications.
Yes. Did you run across the Controlled Impact Rescue Tool?
No.
This is something, if you've heard of the company Raytheon, you probably yes. associate them with defense technology and microwave ovens. But among other things, many, many other things. This is sort of high-end weapons grade firefighting technology. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at a concrete wall and you need to get inside because there's a fire on the other side and you've absolutely got to do this, getting through that's going to take you a long time using conventional tools. So, this is a prototypical tool, or at least it was at the time the article I'm used as a source is written. It uses blank ammunition cartridges and fires those into the wall to make the wall crumble. Just from the shock waves of firing the blanks into the wall. The equipment weighs about 100 pounds, which means that you've got to have two firefighters carrying the equipment up there. But it doesn't require any electricity. You know, it's essentially a gun. But you can use the device to basically pound your way through a thick concrete wall a lot faster than you could if you were trying to use a jackhammer or electric saw.
I can easily see a fictionalized version of that weapon being used in video games from here on out.
Oh, sure. And then did you read anything about using electricity to fight fires?
Yes, yes. That is one of the ones that I wanted to talk about. Over in Harvard University, some researchers discovered something interesting. They found that, it's been known that flames will react to an electric field mm-hmm. for quite some time. But what the researchers at Harvard University found was that by using a variable electric field, which means they were using alternating current to travel across a wire, they would create this variable electric field. They would direct it toward a flame, and they discovered that it would snuff a flame out. And what was at work here was that the variable electric field was actually exerting force on charged particles within the flame itself.
Mm-hmm. Probably carbon particles from what I read.
Yeah. And it's pushing those particles away from the fuel source. So it's literally pushing the flame off the fuel. So it snuffs it out, you know, and the rest of the fuel remains unburned. But this is just a small kind of laboratory setting, it's not like a field test. And moreover, this sort of application is really going to be useful for small confined spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So any place where a fire might break out in a tiny area, like let's say it's a compartment in a ship, like a Navy vessel.
Okay.
And it's down below decks and you have a fire breakout. Well, this could be a good way to contain that fire, to snuff out that fire quickly. you know, that you've got a, again, a pretty confined space in that when you're working with that. If you're talking about something like a house fire mm-hmm. or a wildfire, this approach is not necessarily going to be very effective. So it's not like we can just make a massive electric wand pointed at California and say, you're done. No more fires for you.
Right.
It's not going to happen that way. Plus, a lot of people are going to be mad that their tiki torches just went out.
Nice.
Thank you.
But yeah, you could use it to escape a fire if you were in this situation.
That's a good point. Yeah, you can make a lane.
Yeah. The article I read on it basically said if you were a firefighter inside a building and there were a wall of fire in front of you, you could, you know, create an escape route for yeah. yourself by using this on a small area. Enough to get through and to the other side safely.
Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't be able to necessarily put out the fire, but you could at least create an avenue to get out of that situation.
Or it could be used as a sort of to augment a sprinkler system mounted on the ceiling so that you could, you know, use that on a small area within a building, which would be kind of interesting. I don't know. It would sort of depend on the type of equipment that you were working with. And if you had something like electronic equipment.
Yeah. Yeah, and you got to remember that you're generating an electric field. You're not shooting lightning out the end of something. So yeah. That is something to remember. It's not like you're blasting stuff with lightning and then the fire goes out. That'd be cool, but it's not what's happening. Did you read about using acoustic waves to put out flames?
No, I didn't.
All right. So this is another one of those things where it's an idea that could have potential, but it's going to take some more tests and some more experimentation to really find out if it's a worthwhile pursuit.
Okay.
The idea is that you use acoustic waves, so sound, to snuff out flames. And there were some early experiments done, mostly by students, really, like science students, mm-hmm. college level and even lower, where they would use a really sort of a low frequency sound, like we're talking about in the 40 hertz frequency range.
Wow.
And boost it up really powerfully. And when brought close to a flame, the flame would go out. And, the idea is that we might be able to use this kind of technology in areas where there's, zero gravity. For example, a space station. Mm-hmm. So if a fire broke out in a space station, that would be catastrophic. It's also really unusual because, you know, flames behave in a really odd way in outer space. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the lack of gravity. So instead of a teardrop shaped flame that you might see on a candle here on Earth,
yeah.
in space, it's round because mm-hmm. there's no up and there's no down. There's no, you know, the heat doesn't go up. The heat just stays where it is and it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And it does, but yeah, heat doesn't travel. It doesn't go outward. There's no, which is kind of hard to get your head around, but it's also in the outer space in a place like the space station, using water is not terribly effective either. Mm-hmm. It doesn't behave the same way in a zero G environment. Using foam is really messy and dangerous, potentially dangerous as well. So that's why they're looking at various alternatives to using a physical substance. Really, the basis of fighting fires up to this point has been chemical.
Mm-hmm.
You're aiming at the fuel and you're trying to put out the flame that way. This is more of a physical way of fighting fire. You're physically finding a way to remove the flame from the fuel and thus snuff it out.
Mm-hmm.
And both the electric field and the acoustic wave methods fall into that category. Well, I'm tapped out. Do you have anything else you want to add before we sign off?
No, but I think, you know, and over the course of talking about these things, there are other firefighting technologies we didn't talk about.
Sure.
So
we might come back and revisit.
I'm interested in maybe revisiting it in the future. I do also want to point out that, all these technologies are very important to people who are very important to us because they help protect us. And,
yeah.
Just want to send our thanks. You know,
oh, yeah.
If I may speak for you.
Definitely.
To the firefighters of the world for looking out for all of us because you have a very difficult job.
Yeah. The training regimen alone to become a firefighter is one of the most difficult things I've read about. I mean,
yeah.
it's up there with, you know, the elite military training in a way. I mean,
depending,
and they have to go through some pretty intense situations just to get to the point where they're putting their lives at risk to help you. So yeah, my hat is off to the firefighters out there.
Absolutely.
Thank you, men and women of the various firefighting agencies. So that wraps it up for this discussion. If you guys have any specific fields of technology you would like us to tackle, let us know. You can let us know on Twitter and Facebook. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW, or you can send us an email. That address is TechStuff@HowStuffWorks.com. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL Schedule Release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit nfl.com/schedule-release to learn more.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.